Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Tim Ryan of the College of Central Florida. Tim is a mentor of mine, a close friend, and a legend. Tim comes from the corporate world and came to coaching a little bit later in life, has a unique perspective and approach to recruiting and management, and really a great story for anybody who feels like they're too late in life to make the jump into basketball, or really just anyone who feels like they're too late in life to follow their dream. This is a great story, a great lesson, and amongst his accomplishments, which I name as soon as we get started with the interview, Tim also was a member of USA Basketball as an assistant coach, along with Shaka Smart, Tony Bennett, and Buzz Williams, amongst others, and is a member of the Florida Community College Hall of Fame. And when you hear how he got his start and how he got the job there, that becomes even more impressive, the accomplishments that he's been able to achieve. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and we hope to see you in Charlotte, July 19th through the 21st at our conference. Sign up at our website, risingcoacheselite.com. Coach Ryan, how are you?
Good, Adam. Excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you for jumping on the podcast. I'm excited. This is a special one for me because, you know, you are one of my mentors and helped get me in the business, and I think you have a really unique perspective to share with everybody. So I'm excited.
Awesome. Glad to be.
Yeah. So let me just give a little background, give you the little intro. And I usually do this before we start talking, but, for people that don't know you or are familiar with your career, and jump in if I get any of this wrong, but 9-time conference coach of the year, 9-time conference champion. And then of course, 2013 national championship at College of Central Florida. Did I miss anything?
No, that's correct. That's good.
Pretty impressive numbers. And when you talk about how you got into it and your start, I think it'll be, you know, I don't know if more impressive, but it'll just give perspective for where you came from and how you got it. So let's jump in. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you got into it, because my understanding, I don't know that I know this full story, is you came to college coaching at least a little bit later in life.
I did, Adam. I was a when I got out of college, I have a much different path, I think, than most people. When I got out of college, I had no inkling of being a coach. I played one year of Division III JV basketball. And I grew up loving basketball, played at a big time high school, played at Powell Memorial, you know, where Jabbar went, Chris Mullen, Lenny Elmore, a lot of great players. I wasn't one of those great players, but I did play there. And I went on to a Division III school, played 1 year and kind of got out of it. And when I graduated from college, I went to the Air Force. I went to fly planes, went out to Arizona, my wife and I, we moved out there. And when I got out of the Air Force, I moved to Clearwater, Florida. And I moved there mainly because I didn't want to go. I was from New York. I didn't want to go back up to New York. We were out in Arizona. We wanted to come back to the East Coast. So we went to Clearwater, Florida. And I wanted to get into banking. I thought that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to find a job in banking. So, but one of the first things I did when I moved to Clearwater was something that I had always done wherever I was I was always involved in the community in some aspect. So I went down to the local rec center in Safety Harbor, Florida, and I asked them, is there anything I can help do? And I didn't know if they were going to ask me to ref a volleyball game, sell hot dogs at the Little League baseball game. But I told them my background, and they said, well, would you coach our basketball team? I was 26, 27 years old. Would you coach our, I think it was 11-year-old kid? So I said, great, I'd be happy to do that. I didn't even have a job yet. I'd only been in the state about a week and a half. So I did that. It was a 6-week season, and I had a lot of fun doing it. But in the meantime, while that season was going on, I ended up getting a job at Citibank down here in Clearwater, Florida. I ended up starting my family. You know, we ended up buying a house. So I was into a lot of other things, and I decided, well, you know, that was fun, but I've got to get on with my life now. I've got to go into my serious corporate world here. So about a year and a half went by, and this is not like a proud story of my life that I'm about to tell you, but this is a true story, how I got into coaching. I was about a year and a half after I was working at Citibank. The Citibank in New York, the marketing department, sent out a survey wanting to know what everybody in the entire company did. Now, there's 50,000 employees that worked for Citibank at the time there were. And they wanted to know what you did in the community. So I was the first time in my life I didn't do anything in the community. So I went to the I went to my boss and I said, you know, I don't have anything to put down. And she said, I thought you were a basketball coach. I said, I did that before I started working here, but I don't do that anymore. So she said, just put it down. Don't worry about it. So I said, okay. So I put it down in the survey. 50,000 employees. About 3 weeks after I turned the survey in, I get a phone call home. It was a Monday night. I'll never forget it. And I, this is back when we had, you know, cords on our phone. And I get a phone call, and it's the Citibank marketing department in New York City calling me, telling me they want to do an interview for their national newspaper on me coaching these kids at this rec center.
Holy
and
God.
I was like, oh, my God. Yeah, I was lying. You know, and I'm thinking, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my job over this. I just bought a new house. I've got a kid on the way. So, you know, naturally what I did was I lied again. I said, okay, what questions do you have? And the guy says, no. We want to come down this Saturday and take pictures of you coaching this team. So I was like, I didn't know what to say. I said, okay, great. Come on down. So I hung up the phone.
This is like
a
movie.
And I called the guy. Yeah. I called the guy at the rec center. And I said, the guy, my friend, I knew the guy. And I told him my situation. And he says, Tim, don't worry about it. He says, come down Thursday night. Meet the kids. I'll meet the kids at practice. Learn their names. And on Saturday, when they get here, you can coach them, and they won't know any better. So I did that. I coached the game. I went down that Thursday. I met, learned the kids' names. These guys come down on Saturday to take pictures and do an interview, and they don't know any better. The newspaper comes out. It's a nationwide newspaper. It's me on the front page of this Citibank's newspaper coaching these guys, and it's a total lie. It was an absolute total lie. So, but one of the things, but this guy saved my butt. So, but one of the things this guy at the rec center said was, listen, I'll do this for you as long as you come back for next season and coach a full season. So I said, no problem. Absolutely. I'll do that. But so I ended up going back the next season and I did it. And I realized, you know what? I could handle all of this. I could handle my team. I could handle doing these, coaching this rec team. I could handle my work and my family. It didn't take that much time. And I ended up doing that for the next 6 years. And just the more I did it, the more I got into it. And I just really loved the aspect of coaching. And people from time to time would say, well, coach, why don't you go down to the local high school and coach? And I said, you know, I don't have time. Again, I use that excuse, I don't have time. Well, after 6 years, I ended up doing that. I was 32 years old. And I went down to the local high school, Clearwater Catholic, and I spoke to the varsity coach and told him my situation. And he said, well, you want to be my freshman coach? And I said, great. I'd love to be your freshman coach. And I did that for 2 years. And then they made me the JV coach. You know, and I remember sitting on that bench, on that JV bench, and we had just lost the game. I was the head coach of the JV team, and I was the assistant on the varsity. And we had just lost a JV game, and I was coming out, sitting on the bench of the varsity game, and I remember sitting there thinking, man, life doesn't get better than this. I'm coaching high school basketball. You know, I was just so in love with what I was doing. I was learning as much as I could. I was going to clinics all over the country, just trying to learn as much as I could. And I remember those days, you know, driving around in my car. So I was a banker during the day. I was still in the banking business. I wasn't a teacher. And I remember driving around those days, listening to sports talk radio, thinking, man, I would just love to be able to do something in sports full time. You know, if I could coach, that would be tremendous. But I never saw that as a possibility because by this time I had a couple of kids. I was well into my banking career, and I just never saw that as being probable for me. But after 2 years as a JV coach, I ended up getting a job as a head coach at St. Pete Catholic. And I did that for 3 years. And now I'm coaching AAU. I'm going to clinics. I'm going to camp all over the place. Probably coaching about 150 games a year. So at the end of that third year, I was 39 years old. And I if it was heroin, I would have overdosed. You know, I was just so much into it. So I went over to Hillsborough Community College, and I put a suit on one day, knocked on the guy's door, Derek Worrells, and I'd never met him before. Now we're best friends. And I asked him, I told him my situation. I said, I really want to try to get into college coaching. So he said, look, I have no job for you, but you could be a volunteer. So I said, that'll be great. You know, I'd love to be a volunteer. So I volunteered for him for a year. I'm still being a banker. And after my first year, he put me on staff. And I say put me on staff, you know, that was like $250 a year, you know, right. Big money. So, and in the third year.
So not enough to quit you didn't quit your bank job yet.
not yet. So after my third year, after my second year, he made me associate coach for the third year. And we were real successful at the time. We went to the state tournament two of those 3 years. We did fairly well. We won the conference both of those years. And I was just really excited to be a part of this. I mean, this was a dream, you know. And I thought this was it. You know, I'll be a banker and I'll be a coach here, and this will be great. And then after my third year, the job came open here at the College of Central Florida. And I believe there were 180 people that applied for the job. And a lot of those guys were Division I coaches, ex-head coaches. It was a really, you know, it was a good spot right here in the middle of Florida. So they interviewed three people. I put my name in without a prayer. Here I am, part-time JUCO coach and a banker. And I'm going up against these guys that are all Division I coaches, full-time guys. So I put my name in the hat and applied. They interviewed three guys, and one of them was not me. They interviewed Scott McMillan, and actually, they ended up giving Scott the job. But 4 days after Scott got the job here, he got the job down at Lynn University, and he opted to take the job at Lynn. They went to the next guy, who was an assistant coach at the University of Jacksonville, and offered it to him, and he was actually from Ocala. And he was not happy that he was not the first choice, and he turned it down. And the third guy they interviewed, they didn't like him. So they ended up opening up again, and they brought in three coaches. They brought in myself. They brought in a guy with 17 years of Division I experience as an assistant, and they brought another guy with 5 years as an assistant coach at Division I that had, again, he was from Ocala, Florida, where our school is at. And during the interview process, I realized that I had a real shot at this because my athletic director, he made several comments that he really didn't want to bring a Division I guy in. And, you know, I could do the math. I was the only guy that wasn't a Division I guy. So at the end of the day, I ended up getting the job and, you know, been blessed ever since. I was 43 years old when I got this job. I think JUCO was perfect level for me. The things that we're able to do here for kids. You know, these are second chance kids, and I really believe that that's what I'm here for is to help get these kids to the next level, give them a shot. It's not always about the basketball. To me, it's really, and it's not always about the degree. It's about the education. So I've been really fortunate. You know, when I got this job, and I know you've heard this story before, when I got this job, the first thing the newspaper asked me, the very first question they asked me was, so coach, how do you feel about being second choice? And I told them very honestly, I said, you know, being second choice doesn't bother me at all because this wasn't my first choice, but Kentucky was taken. So I'll take this job right here.
Very good.
But that's the story of how I got here, you know, and then everything else, the success that we've had, I've been blessed to have a lot of great players. But it's kind of a different route than most people have taken. And this is a dream job. Having this job has been a dream job for me. Like I said, I remember driving around in my car when I was a banker thinking, you know, I didn't hate being a banker. But I thought that there's something else out there for me, and I found it. And this has been a dream for me.
What a story. There's so much I want to go back and ask.
Go ahead.
But I think the first thing that I want to point out is, you know, we get so many people contact us through Rising Coaches that are, you know, not fresh out of college and that are, you know, in their 30s. and they kind of feel hopeless in terms of getting their foot in the door. But you really didn't get your first college job till what, 39?
39. I was a volunteer assistant.
So, what it took is you willing to do it on a volunteer basis to get your foot in the door.
Absolutely.
And you just showed up. It's not like you had connections to this guy. You and Derek at the time didn't know each other at all. You just kind of put yourself out there.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I called him. I called him, and he picked up one time and said he would get back to me. Now, Derek's a good friend of mine, so I can say this about him. But then I called him, I want to say 15 times, and never heard back from him. So I really wanted this. So I just put a suit on one day and went up to his office and knocked on his door. And I think he was impressed by that, or was just had a hard time saying no. I don't know.
Some people get security called on them for just showing up on people at people's office.
We'll be the first time I've had security called on me, but that's another story.
Well, that's great. I love hearing that, you know, all the persistence that went into getting that opportunity. It certainly didn't just fall into your lap. What do you think you learned from all the games? I mean, you said you were coaching at one point maybe 150 games a year when you were juggling, you know, the rec center and AAU and the JV team. What do you think that did for you as a young coach, getting to get started by getting that many reps?
You know, I just learned so much. You know, I can tell you, when I was probably in my early 30s, before I got the first job at Clearwater Catholic as a freshman coach, I remember I went to see a high school game, and it was Clearwater Catholic versus Countryside versus, I think, Dixie Holland, and two teams down in Pinellas County. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, I'm 38 years old, 29 years old. And I remember sitting there thinking, man, I could do a better job than these coaches. I could do better than this. And when I first got that coaching job at Clearwater Catholic, I realized how little I knew about coaching, you know, and I had so much to learn. There were so many things, you know, about the X's and the O's of the game, but also about dealing with the kids, the parents. Those things helped me so much at that level. And my hunger was, I just couldn't learn enough. I remember going to clinics and listening to UB Brown speak and guys like that. And I was probably 33, 34. And I thought I knew something about the game and I thought I was hungry for the game. And I listened to those guys talk and I walk away thinking, my God, they're different. They're just another level of what I know and my desire. They were so hungry and it was inspirational to me. You know, because I wanted to know more. I wanted to make my living doing this, but I just didn't know how, so I just kept at it.
And I want to tell you, I think when I came to work for you, I think it was maybe your third year as head coach there. Does that sound right?
Yep, that does.
And you still had that, like, it was really clear to me that you still had that hunger to learn, and really almost like a humbleness about it. You never pretended to know more than anybody else and were always asking questions. And I mean, you were asking questions of me and I was clueless. I was 22, just BSing my way through it. But I was always really impressed by that you were always wanting to learn. And I think you had a great way with people. And so I want to ask you, you know, about maybe some lessons that you took from, you know, the corporate world in terms of management, in terms of recruiting, because I know as your employee, I saw your strength as being a tremendous manager of people, a great communicator, and really a great salesman.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I did learn a lot, you know, in the corporate world, especially about sales, about how to handle people. I think handling, you know, for me though, handling the kids here is, it's just a passion. It's an honesty. It's looking out. Now I go to work every day and it's about what's in the best interest of the kids and what's, you have to look at the team as a whole. but you also want to help each kid individually. You know, when we talk about that, we can't put the kid before the team, but you want to look out for their interest. But, you know, as far as the sales go, I learned so many things, and especially about recruiting is sales is it's a numbers game, first of all. People want to. Some people say they're better salesmen than others. I think it's just about a numbers game, and I learned that in sales. You know, first of all, we know that in sales, let me get this stat right, 80% of all sales are made by 20% of the salespeople. 80% of the sales are made by 20% of the salespeople. And the reason for that is that 80% of salespeople give up after the second call. 80% give up after the second call. It's going to be too hard. It's going to be too tough. So they stop. But what we know in sales is that 80% of all sales are done, are made after the fifth sales call. So if 80% are made after the fifth sales call and 80% are given up, you know, it leaves a big pie for the people that keep going hard, for the people that don't give up, the people that have been rejected, the people that don't stop. And I think that big with me when taking over this program. I've heard coaches at my level, when I took this program over, you know, we were not the top dog in our conference. And within a few years, maybe 5 or 6 years, I heard people saying that, you know, they can't compete with us on the recruiting trail. And I thought that was really negative of them to think that, because I never thought that of myself. I always gave myself a shot at least attempting to go after that better player. You know, a lot of these guys, and I think that comes from the corporate world for me. A lot of these guys, at least at my level, they think, and I hear that too from Division I, and, you know, we can't get that guy. And sometimes it's true, you know. I never stopped from sticking my nose in and seeing what happens, because I think that persistence eventually pays off. And we've had some really good players here because I was willing to stick my nose in, you know, against some guys that, you know, we got Ricardo Ratliff here. When Ricardo was here, and he was a athlete of the year for the entire country for every sport, junior college. And when I was able to get him, you know, I had to go up against guys like, you know, the big dogs of the world, you know, the Chipolas and the Miami Dades. At the time, Miami Dade was really good, and the Northwest and those guys. And we were able to get him here. And most people wouldn't have given us a shot at that.
I think another thing that always stood out to me, and, you know, first of all, your office and the assistant coach's office are connected at College of Central Florida. It still is. And so, you know, I would sit at my desk and you'd be making recruiting calls, and I basically, you know, get to listen in on every single one of them and learn things just, you know, through osmosis. But one thing that always stood out to me was, you know, and you used to always say this, the best thing you can tell me is you're coming, and the second best thing you can tell me is you're not coming. And it seemed like you really had no fear of rejection in that regard. And also, it also seemed like sometimes you would challenge them, you know, a little bit in that, you would tell them, you know, almost every time, the first thing you tell them is like, hey, this place isn't for everybody. It might not be for you. And I'd be sitting there like, coach, I've spent a month trying to get this kid on the phone. You know, what are you doing? You're going to scare him off. But I thought that was a tactic that was really, really effective for you. Probably still is. And is that something you got from the corporate world too? Or is that just, where'd you get that from?
You know, I think I got that from coaches. You know, I think that you put everything up front, you get it on the table right away. You know, when I'm going to go against when I'm recruiting against someone that head to head, and I've got to point out what their positive things are right away. You know, I think that helps me. The thing that I can't overcome, because what they have is so good, I'm going to put that on the table. We're going to talk about it.
You're talking about your competition. So if you're going head to head.
My competition, I'm sorry.
With junior college.
Yeah, my competition. So I'm also going to tell these guys what we are here about. You know, I had a guy on the phone today, an international kid. This is just earlier today. Dad played 30 years of pro ball over in Europe. The kid wants to come here. He's 6'8". He's great rebounder, and the dad is insisting that he's got to play the three. He said, "Coach, I have heard so many good things about you. He knows people on over in Europe that know me, and they said all these great things." And he said, "Coach, I wanted to come here, but he's got to play the three." And I said, "Well, I'm going to tell you up front, he's not going to play the three here. You know, it's just the way it is, and it's we'd love to have your son. I think we can help your son. I think we, you know, all these other things, but you've got to be upfront with these guys, because why do we want to get a kid here that doesn't understand our what we're about, you know?" And so, yes, I do go in and challenge these guys right away and tell them what this is, what people say about us. You know, we have a lot of structure here. And when you talk to another coach at another school, the first thing they're going to bring up is our structure, that we have too much structure, but this is what we do. And you need to understand that.
Give us a little sneak peek of like the structure that you're talking about. Like, what does a day entail for your guys? And then maybe tell me why you operate like that.
Yeah, well, we meet every morning at 7:30 for breakfast. Whether they have class or not, they have to be at breakfast every day. We go to classes between the hours of 8 and 12:15. At 2 o'clock, we have practice from 2 to 4:30. 4:30, they go back, they shower, they eat. At 6 o'clock, they're back in mandatory and monitored study hall from 6 to 8. At 8 o'clock, they can come over to the gym, they get shots up, go to the weight room. And then every single night, you know, we kick them out at 10 if they're still here, and send them back to their dorms. But every single night, just not on the game nights, not just during school nights, not just during the season, but every night they're here, they have curfew. Curfew is 11:30 during the week, 1 o'clock on the weekends. If you miss class, every player goes to class. If you miss class, the next day we have the entire team does a 3-mile run at 6 o'clock in the morning if one kid misses class. You know, we do those things because we think structure works. We think that it's important that our kids not just get a degree from us, but get an education. When I took over this program 16 years ago, I wanted to be a top-tier team. And I looked at the top-tier teams. I looked at the guys in our, and I don't mention names. I looked at the guys in our league that were top tier. I looked at the guys in our region and throughout the country. And I looked at those guys, and the first thing I noticed that they all had in common was that they had a tremendous graduation rate, So I thought, how did they get that graduation rate so high? When I took this over here, we had a 67% graduation rate. Now, 67% doesn't sound great, but the national average for junior college is something like I don't know what it is, like 28%, which is terrible. But you had these big boys had all these graduation rates of 95-96%. And so I thought, how do they do that? Man, that's great, but how do we get that done? And then I started to investigate a little further, and I found out these guys with these high graduation rates, their kids were going to schools, and then they weren't graduating from the schools they went to. They had a horrible graduation rate. In fact, when the NCAA came in 6-7 years ago and changed the rules for JUCO, used to be a 2-0, then they moved it to a 2-5. The biggest reason they gave for doing that, Adam, was that the graduation rate of kids that had graduated from junior college went on to Division I. The graduation rate from the Division I school was 16% for the junior college kids. That to me was terrible. And the reason it was so low was because kids weren't getting an education. They're just getting a degree. And we weren't going to have that here. So I had to find a way to get our graduation rate up and to do it in a way, though, our kids were getting an education. And so structure was what I came up with. And it's why I do it the way I do it. We've had an unbelievable success rate. You know, our graduation rate today is 92% from our school. We think that's really good. But even what's more impressive is that the time of that of that statistic, when they came out with that statistic 6 years ago about only 16% were graduating from the Division I schools, junior college kids, our graduation rate for our kids, we had many that went to Division I, was 93%, while the national average is 16. So I think it works. You know, I come from a family that believes in education. You know, my mom was a lady that got a high school certificate. She didn't even get a high school degree. Couldn't go on to college because she had to work. We came from a really poor family. And when she passed away, my sister, who's a Methodist minister, gave a eulogy. And all six of her kids, we grew up in a housing project, dirt poor. All six of her kids went on to get their master's, beyond college. So it kind of shows you, like, the education part is really instilled in me. And I want these kids to have an education when they leave here.
Well, and I'll tell you, the reason the structure works is because you're relentless with it. And it doesn't matter if you're the best player or the worst player. Those are the rules. If you don't follow them, here's the consequences, and no exceptions.
And that's we've had to, unfortunately, you know, unfortunately, we don't get every kid to follow it. And we've had to ask some really good players to leave here, you know, and that has happened. But that's not a everyday occasion, but every once in a while that does happen.
Well, and that's what makes it so effective, I think, is that you're not afraid to, you know, if your best player isn't living up to those standards, you're not afraid to bench them, to get rid of, you know, whatever needs to be done. But you're never, and I'm sure there's temptation, and I don't know how you've dealt with this, especially as a young coach, but you never sacrifice your standards for your best player or your best talent.
Well, we like to think we have, you know, we try to stick to that. I feel like there's always a fine line, but we always got to put the team and the player first. You know, it's when I say the player, I mean, like, what's really in his best interest. You know, I hear people say all the time about kids, Adam, they go, you know, we have your best interest. We want to see you be successful. We want to see you be successful. And I hear that all the time. And, you know, what do they mean by that? What do they mean to be successful? They want to see him play on TV. They want to see him play in a pro league somewhere. Like, I tell them straight up that that's not what we're about. Like, I want to see you successful. And if you happen to play pro ball somewhere, that's great for you. You happen to play on, you know, for Auburn, you know, we had a kid in the Final Four this year. That's great for you. But what are you doing 5 years after you leave the league, you know, or after you finish playing basketball? What are you doing with your life? And, you know, I think if I'm letting a kid slide because he's a great basketball player, I'm not helping him on that journey. And so I'm thinking of him, not just my team, when I'm putting him on the bench.
Oh, that's great stuff. All right, I want to talk a little bit about the national championship team. And
I love talking about that.
I'm sure you do. you've had a ton of high major guys come through your program over the years. As I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was a team made up of all low to mid-major players. And even though you guys won the national championship and played through the last day of Hutch, like, this is something I heard all the time as a Division I assistant, is I'd be talking to guys and somebody would have a great game in the opening round of the national tournament and they'd say, oh, that guy's over our head now. Like, he had a great game in Hutch. It's over with. All the big dogs are going to come in and want to recruit him. Like, your starting point guard for that team was a tremendous player and had no Division I offers. Is that right?
Yeah, he did. He had some guys talking to him at the end, but he had no Division I offers. He had a couple guys talking to him at the end, but decided on the University of Tampa. That's correct.
And he was a Division II All-American and easily could have helped a lot of Division I programs.
Absolutely. He was good enough to be a Division I kid. Absolutely.
And then you had, and I'm just going off the top of my head, but Jordan Parks was a 6'7 pogo stick. And no disrespect to NC Central, because they do a tremendous job, but he easily could have helped a lot of mid-major plus programs, I would imagine. And he was a all-conference player at NC Central and went to the tournament. But it just seemed like you had a collection of winners They were obviously talented, but they weren't, you know, SEC, ACC type guys. But maybe you can tell us a little bit about, you know, recruiting from your perspective when kids, when guys are recruiting your kids, what they're looking for and why they miss on some guys like that that can really help.
You know, Adam, I can't really talk for other people why they miss. We all miss, you know, I miss on kids. But I think our kids, that team, we had one mid-major kid on the team. We had one mid-major kid, Eugene McCorry, went to UCF and then actually ended up at Tampa University. You know, Jordan Parks, guys just didn't fit the bill. You know, I had Jeremiah Eason was our foreman. He was about 6'5", 6'6", 240 pounds, just really strong, rugged kid, not greatly skilled, but could rebound the heck out of the ball. When I recruited him, everyone told me he was a D2 kid, would never be better than a D2 kid. You know, kid had 16 rebounds in the championship game out in Hutch. Just a fighter, played his role, understood he couldn't shoot the ball for, you know, worth nothing, and did what he was supposed to do. And that whole team really, for the most part, bought into it. We had one kid that was kind of a selfish player. He was a selfish player at the start of the season. He was probably a selfish player at the end of the season. But those guys, the rest of the guys on that team, when you have seven or eight guys that are really buying into what you do, they forced him to buy in what we do. And because he was a good kid, he was just kind of selfish on the court. And they really forced him into buying into our system. You know, the unique thing about that team was we had only two guards on the entire team. Well, I'm sorry, back up. We had two guys that could play at this level on that team. We had our point guard and our two guard, Suarez, and everybody else on the team was either a four or five. We didn't have really a three man on the team, and we had to convert those fours and fives into three men. So we couldn't get those guards in trouble. So we had to play zone that year. And that zone just kept getting better and better, and those guys bought into it. And was by the end of the year, I think the end of the season, we had held our opponents. We were number one in the country that year in defensive field goal percentage to 36.1%. And in the last six games of the year against the best teams in the country, they held their opponents to 35.1%. That's how good that zone had gotten over the course of the year. And it was really, you know, I had run zone before. Did we run zone when you were here, Adam, at all?
No, maybe as a change up here and there, but not really.
Yeah, we didn't run much zone. I was mostly man-to-man, and I ran that year because the makeup of the team. And I couldn't let those guards get in foul trouble. I didn't have anybody else to play. So we played zone for that particular reason, and it just ended up becoming really, really good. Everybody bought into it. You know, obviously, while you're winning, guys buy into it more. And that's what happens. It's funny, though. At the end of the season, I'm getting asked to do clinics on the 2-3 zone. You know, I'd never ran it before. You know, but we used it and won a championship, so everybody wanted to know what I was doing.
That's funny. All right, the last thing I want to talk about, I know I got to let you go here in a minute, is some of what you do in the community there in Ocala. I know you get a ton of support and do a lot of fundraising, you know, at that level. That's so crucial. And I think you do a great job in that department. Obviously, it was set up. I think some of that stuff was already in tow a little bit with what Coach Smitson, Mean Gene Smitson, did before you. Who, those of you who don't know him, Google him, and he's a legend you know, probably laid the foundation there at Central Florida. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the things that you do that are unique? Obviously, you have a golf tournament, which a lot of programs have, but it seems like you've taken that booster club to another level.
Yeah, we do. You know, actually, the raising of the money and that kind of stuff comes off of the golf tournament. But what we do is we have a tremendous atmosphere in our gym. We get a lot of people into our gym. I think we're fourth in the country in attendance this year in junior college. We're required by our school to do one community service, I think, per semester. But what we do here is we do one community service a month. So that we're, our guys are out in the community a lot. Like, you know, we did something recently for St. Jude's, Cone, Distributor, which is a big company here in Ocala. They did something for St. Jude's where they had a horse shooting contest, you know, and not a horse, a game of horse. I'm sorry. Game of horse.
Big difference.
I'd word that differently. You know, game of horse, and we had our guys involved in that, and they raised, I can't remember how much money we raised for St. Jude's for that. And then we do things like, you know, we go out for the Salvation Army and we'll, have our guys, ring the bells in front of the, at Christmas time for the, money for the Salvation Army that they collect. The March of Dimes, they call it March of Babies, now, our guys will go out and participate, you know, handing out water for the guys, for the people that are walking.
So you guys are out in the community. You have a relationship with Cone Distributing, which is a major company. What about, you know, because I hear a lot of people complain that their school doesn't have resources and there's no meals. You know, we only have a cafeteria for breakfast.
Yeah.
You know, that's a similar deal there, but you went out and found extra meals.
Yeah. Well, Coach Mitchell started that, and you're right. You know, first of all, hats off to Coach Mitchell, tremendous coach and a big influence and a big help to me here getting my feet wet at Central Florida. We have a meal sponsorship program here in Ocala where we have 17 sponsors. And what we do is each night we feed our kids breakfast and lunch during the day in our cafeteria Monday through Friday. And then every night a different restaurant in town feeds our kids. And on the weekends, every meal on the weekends. And what we do is our manager goes and he picks up the food. And we have people like Olive Garden, Carrabba's, Cody Steakhouse, Freddy's, PDQ's. There's 17 of them. Domino's is on there. These guys support us really well. And in exchange for that, what we do is we put a media guide together. And we put an advertisement in the media guide for them. We also put up, a signage in the gym. We give them 10 free tickets to every home game. And then we give them a corporate night where we put their names on the tickets and we bring them down in front of the crowd before every game, not for every game, but we bring them down in front of the crowd, on their night and thank them in front of everybody and hand them a plaque and everybody gets up and gives them a hand and we get a picture with them and put them on Facebook, on social media. You know, thanking these guys for what they do for us. And it's really an easy sell. You know, people want to help us. They want to be part of our program, throughout the community. So we're really blessed to be in the place that we are, the community that we are.
Well, and I think it just goes back to, maybe your persistence and dealing with, you know, fear of not really having that fear of rejection, because I was the one that had to always go out and try to convince these restaurants. This was my job you gave me. And I thought it was nuts, but it was. It was incredible, like, how many, you know, you give them, you put together, you know, a really nice presentation, you know, a form letter, right, and some information, a packet that you give them. You go, you speak to the general manager, you give them the packet, they run it up the corporate ladder, and, you know, within a week they're calling you back saying, yeah, no problem, we'll give you a meal for 15 guys for every week of the year. And that's an unbelievable amount of value that you're getting. But, you know, for guys, because I think there's a lot of people out there who feel like they're limited in resources. Well, you got to get creative and you got to ask, because people will help you.
You got to think outside the box. But you said something very valuable to me there. You said that you did that when you were here. I got to tell Adam that, because I'm doing that now. So I got to switch that over.
What are you doing? That was never, you always delegated that one. That's the other thing. You're a very good delegator. No,
Adam will agree with that.
Coach, I really appreciate you taking the time. And like I said, it was special for me to get to do this with you, because you helped me get into the business and have been a tremendous mentor for me. And I appreciate everything you've done for me personally, as well as professionally, but more personally than anything.
Well, thank you, Adam. I appreciate all those kind words. And, you know, you were great to work with. And I'm just really so happy to see your success and what you've done in the business. And you know, you've helped my assistants along the way, and that's really greatly appreciated, as well as helping me along the way. And that's not forgotten. So thank you very much, Adam. Appreciate it. Appreciate you having me on. It was fun.
Thanks, Coach. Talk to you later.